Flawless, Inside the Largest Diamond Heist in History. Greg Campbell is the co-author. He's also the author of Blood Diamonds. So our first hour, we talked a little bit about the status of blood diamonds in the world and led us back to Antwerp, which is where the thieves are heading for the greatest diamond heist in history. 2003, they learned from a previous heist to look for flaws in systems. And if you're going to find flaws, then all you have to do is keep finding them until you can work your way through all the levels. We went through some of the levels a few minutes ago, but let's find out what were the flaws in each one of those security levels that led these thieves to 100 million euros worth of diamonds. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So Greg Campbell, co-author of Flawless, Inside the Largest Diamond Heist in History, we were just talking about how they had worked, ingratiated their way inside the building. They were wallpaper now. Two of this group from Turin, Italy, known as the School of Turin, that these five thieves had been sort of casing the joint for years, waiting for their opportunity. And they're seeing that in every level of security at the Antwerp Diamond Center, there is a flaw. And I don't think I've ever had them explained to me like this. So if you would, just other than the original flaw of not bothering to call the cops to check on a tenant, which seems like a natural thing to do if you're going to have so many diamonds in one building and you're going to rent to just anybody that walks off the street. Let's go through the other levels of security that these guys had to get through in order to get to the diamonds.
Sure thing. And let me just make clear that there was just one member of the School of Turin who'd managed to infiltrate in this manner. Another guy had done this a few years before.
Oh, of course. I'm sorry.
The heist that was when it was occurring, only one was within its walls, and that was Notarbartolo.
Of course.
And the other thing I guess to make clear, too, is that it really took a long time. Notarbartolo didn't do it alone. He filmed a lot of what he was seeing. He managed to hide a little video camera in a shoulder bag, and he would very carefully walk around the hallways and through the garage and down to the vault level, and he took a lot of care to film these security measures. And for instance, the brand name of the vault door and of the magnetic alarm on the outside and of the specific motion detector that was visible inside the room. And he sent this information back to Italy. And the other men on his crew, the safecracker, the alarm specialist, those guys were the ones to, you know, look very carefully at these mechanisms and try to determine what, if anything, could be done to sabotage or subvert them. And as you pointed out, the first thing that they noticed was that the human element was a bit complacent, to say the least. You know, he was allowed into this, you know, the fox was allowed into the hen house for 2 years to figure out how to steal the eggs. And that, in fact, was one of the kind of enduring flaws that he managed to find with a bunch of other components to the security system. And as a for instance, the door that was the big giant steel door, you know, a foot thick and weighing a ton, couldn't be blown out of the wall with a bomb. It was required to be locked with two mechanisms. One was a long key, and the other was a combination. And the key was so large, it was so long because the door itself was so wide that in order to reach the mechanism on the inside, that the key itself needed to be nearly a foot long. Well, it's almost impossible to walk around with something like that in your pocket. So the designers of the safe made it so that the end of the key could be removed. You know, the important part, the stamp that actually operates the internal tumblers of the lock, could be removed. And the theory was that part would be placed then in a security guard's pocket during the day while he was walking around with it safe in his pockets. But the pipe, the long stem, could be held, you know, kept near the door or somewhere else that's convenient. Well, the Diamond Center had never been robbed, and clearly no one who worked there expected it to be robbed. Because what Notarbartolo observed was that in this particular instance, the key was never detached into its two parts. The stamp was kept on the end the entire time. And the key was stored in a room adjacent to this big vault door that it locked. So automatically, he figured out one-third of this door's defenses. You had the key, you had the combination, you had the magnetic alarm. One-third of it was simply in a room nearby that they could easily break into.
A no-brainer.
Have access to the key.
Right. I mean, how simple is that? And was not the original design for why that door, how that key was to provide a new level of safety. You know,
that's
it's
right.
Not just have. It's one thing to have a lock. It's another thing to put to tape the key to the door.
that's almost the equivalent. It's sort of like when you leave your house and you know put the key under the mat every day. You
right.
know, and you're observed doing that, then your house is not locked.
Or put your key on the mat, not under it. People coming by and go, "Hey, look, there's a key."
That's right.
All right. So all right. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say, in a similar fashion, the motion detector that was inside the room. It was the motion detector was a 2-in-1 contraption. It observed changes in the infrared energy inside a room, so it detected heat levels, and it also had it mapped the room with like a Doppler radar. It sent out microwaves, and it was sort of like a sonar kind of action, and so anything moving through the room would disrupt that pattern. But by observing what type of device it was, they were able to quickly ascertain that it was a 2-in-1 where both of those detectors had to go off simultaneously, had to detect changes at the same time before an alarm was sound. And they also realized that it was an older model, which allowed people who wanted to subvert it to mask it in some way. You could spray something on top of the motion detector, for instance, and that would eliminate its ability to detect any changes in infrared. Now, the technology has changed in the days. That's actually a much older trick that no longer works with modern motion detectors. And motion detectors these days have a device or an ability to tell when they've been masked in this fashion. So, but again, the human element comes into play, because rather than updating and upgrading the technology as it became available, they simply relied on this much older technology, which turned out to be very easy to thwart. And so the way that the thieves figured out how to knock out the motion detector was to have Nota Bartolo go down to the vault one day, and there's no cameras inside the actual safe room itself, because the tenants there wanted a little bit of privacy as they put the goods in and out of their safe deposit boxes. And then once he was alone, he had the freedom to spray a thick film of hairspray or Vaseline or any type of aerosol onto the lens that detected the infrared changes. And of course, then it was rendered inoperable.
Amazing.
And then on the night of the actual heist itself, and they decided to make certain that it wasn't going to detect any changes, and they placed a kind of a styrofoam little shield over the top of it that just covered it entirely. So it wasn't going to notice any changes in the Doppler effect, and it wasn't going to notice any changes in the infrared technology. And of course, it needs to detect both of those at the same time before that sounded. So with about maybe $5 or $10 worth of material, the motion detector and the infrared detector were knocked out.
You're inside the Antwerp Diamond Centers, are going through the levels of security, which we can only assume they've upgraded since the 2003 heist, correct?
We can assume that.
You'd
yes,
like to
can.
Assume that.
Although there are some things that were not upgraded, because they worked perfectly well, and the door is a good example. The door functioned exactly as it was designed to function. It would have been a waste of time and money to replace the perfectly operable door. So the door is exactly the same. But the assumption is that yes, there have been
yeah.
changes. The ownership of the building is not cooperative to journalists who
I bet.
Want
yeah.
to go and yeah. Revisit in a very right. meticulous manner how the heist of the century occurred on their property.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not in their best interest or their insurance companies. So then we're just going through some of the levels of security. So then they spray painted Vaseline or some hairspray, some heavy liquid onto the lens of the infrared device. They knew that where the key was through the door. What else are we missing? What else did they come up with?
Well, the magnetic alarm on the outside of the door was a particular challenge, because as I mentioned before, it was two magnets. One was on the door and one was on the door jamb. So when the door was open, the two magnets were apart, obviously. And then when the door was closed, they came into contact and created a magnetic field. And it wasn't a strong enough magnetic field that it actually prevented you from pulling open the door. its only purpose was to prevent sort of a, you know, to keep sort of an electronic
seal
signal, yes, and a seal, and it was a constant signal that was going to this offsite security company, and should the door be opened at any time when it wasn't supposed to be, then the security company would know immediately, and they would call the police. So in order to actually open the door, they would have to somehow figure out how to keep these two magnets together, and therefore not set off the alarm. Well, this is one of those sort of ingenious things where all it takes is perhaps looking at it long enough when they figured out that it's bolted to the outside of the door, and therefore they had access to it from the outside. So they just unbolted it, and the magnets stayed together. So they unbolted it from the door, they unbolted it from the door jam, and these two magnets were then carefully, you know, taken apart themselves, and they come up with some piece of metal that they could put over the top of them, overlay the top, so that it would help, you know, keep the seal intact as it moved. But then once the key was inserted and the correct combination entered on the dial, they could open the door, and the alarm would never go off because the two magnets were still together. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense, and yeah. What's so surprising about that is how much that does sound like something out of Ocean's 11.
Well, you know, the thing that was the most surprising thing that I found was that where I expected a lot of James Bond, you know, type of high tech or some sort of, you know, weird, you know, kind of
gadgetry,
gizmo or gadgetry,
yeah.
Exactly. It all turned out to be, you know, household items that knocked out some of this stuff, and then common sense in other areas, because, you know, common sense would dictate that the security personnel, when they were constructing the vault in the first place, would put the magnetic alarm inside the vault, so
right.
That it's impossible to tamper with. But, you know, we spoke with a few security consultants who said that the only possible explanation for putting it on the outside was a cost-saving measure. Perhaps they didn't have that technology when it was installed in 1972, and they wanted to, you know, add it to their, kind of retrofit it to their
right.
Vault. So it's cheaper, much cheaper, to put it on the outside than on the inside.
But by putting it on the outside, though, you know, so here comes Nota Bartolo, who videotapes it, and then he sends that videotape back to the thieves in Turin, and they look at that. Now, do they have to make a mock-up of that? Do they have to make a prototype? What do they have to do in order to figure out that all they have to do is just unbolt it off the door?
Well, there's no evidence that they did any type of a mock-up or prototype or, you know, replica vault or anything
right.
like that. What they probably did, though, is, you know, with things that were simple, like the motion detector, they could simply, you know, buy one that was the exact same model. Some of the colleagues in Turin owned locksmith stores, and so they were capable of, you know, buying the exact type of locks, you know, for these different security doors they would have to
right.
go through, and therefore they could fabricate the keys that were needed. When it comes to the magnetic alarm, you know, I don't know that they would have bought a particular thing. They may well have, but I think the greater point is that it was visible. It's very obvious just by looking at it
right.
that it, you know, the exact size and type of bolts on the outside of the door. And so the police believe that in preparation for pulling off the heist on February 15th, that one of these other guys, the alarm expert, his name is Elio Denorio, he somehow was ferreted into the building as a guest of Nota Bartolo's, or perhaps by using Nota Bartolo's security card and acting as an imposter of him, you know, going in and just kind of, you know, making his way past the guards, that he had gone down to the vault late at night after everything was closed and all the businesses were quiet for the night, and he had gone down and actually unbolted the whole thing and shortened the bolts, because the bolts would have had to be very long to go through the magnets themselves and into the door, and they were, you know, locking bolts. They were very hard to unscrew, and so it was very labor intensive. It was going to take him a few hours to actually get through those bolts. But then they believed that he used a hacksaw to shorten the bolts so that they would only screw into the magnets themselves. And then he actually taped it onto the door using heavy-duty double-sided tape.
He I'll be darned.
Taped the magnet onto the door and onto
taped
the door.
Taped it back on.
So that it was, you know, it still worked perfectly well because the magnetic field was intact.
Sure.
But then on the night of the big heist, they simply needed to just go and then undo the tape so that the device wouldn't have to go through all the rigmarole of unscrewing you know, and going, you know, wrenches and whatnot, trying to get the magnetic alarm off the door.
Now, how about the combination?
Now, the combination is still the biggest mystery, and this is one of the things that we couldn't figure out. We couldn't figure it out because no one else had figured it out. The only people who know for sure how they knew the combination are the thieves, and the thieves didn't cooperate with us for this book. So we went through a great number of theories, and the number one theory, the one that was kind of the most prevalent and seen in, you know, a couple of true crime reenactments, is that Nota Bartolo somehow placed a video camera, like a little pin-style camera, near the door so that it could spy on the little wheel dial and learn the combination as it was entered by the concierges, the security guard. But that has been ruled out by the police, or largely ruled out, and that is because the combination dial has built-in security features that would make this really, really difficult, if not impossible. And the main one is that it's shielded. It's got a hood over the top of the dial, so that there you can't actually view any of the numbers around the circumference of the dial as they're being spun. They're hidden by this hood. Because there is a technique that you can use where you don't necessarily have to know what the number is on top. You can mark a certain, you can mark anywhere on the,
right,
on the dial and learn the different sequence of numbers as long as it corresponds to that mark, and that will open up the door. So that's a security feature to prevent that. But more to the point, through the numbers are then only visible from the very top and through a little window, and the window is distorted with a magnifying lens, and so that means that you must look at a precise focal length in order to see the numbers at all. If you get too close to the little window, then the numbers are distorted beyond recognition. If your head is too far from the window, same result. So you have to kind of get your head precisely above where the numbers are.
Now, wouldn't that bring the question of an inside job then, that there would have been somebody that would have given him the combination?
Well, you know, that was investigated very fully, and the police never identified anyone or found any evidence of an inside job. But what they did find evidence of was, again, more complacency on the part of the guards. They believe one of two things are possible. One is that one of the guards may have written down the combination and kept it in his pocket because he was forgetful. And the more damning theory is that they simply never erased the code from the wheel in the first place. They entered it once, and then they never had to enter it again.
Which means that all they had to do is just turn it? Just turn the knob?
Yeah, you're probably familiar with like a high school style, you know, padlock locker. When you close it, it automatically scrambles the dial.
Right.
The door was too old for that type of technology.
How about that? We'll come back. Greg Campbell, Flawless. We're gone inside the largest diamond heist in history. How did they defeat every layer of security to walk away with 100 million euros in diamonds, which, by the way, are still walking? We'll tell you more about that, too, coming up on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Without a shot fired, without anybody hurt, without any real human contact, five thieves from Turin, Italy, stole 100 million euros worth of diamonds from the basement of the Antwerp Diamond Center, one of the most fortified buildings in the world. Well, or at least so they thought. And each level of security, they found a flaw. And we're just talking about that. The most difficult still to understand is how they got through the combination on the door. But what else? What else did they need to do to get that, to get those diamonds out? And then how did they get busted? What was that simple, completely inexcusable mistake they made that made their flawless plan just have one tiny little flaw afterward? Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Talking with Greg Campbell, author of Flawless. We're inside the Antwerp Diamond Center. So we talked about the failure of the human level of security. Then we talked about the problem with they had a great system set up for the key for the vault that had all of the diamonds in it, and they just forgot to follow their own procedures on that. Plus, then they had a great idea on a kind of electromagnetic seal on the door, which would send off an alarm or alert a security personnel should the seal be broken outside of the time period when it was being allowed to. But they never thought that anybody could just come by and unbolt it from the outside. So they were able to open the door without ever breaking the seal. And then the combination too, which kind of remains a little bit of a mystery. But once they get inside, then they had the motion detectors. They already defeated those, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep, they okay. defeated the motion detector with the spray. Once they opened the door, there was a light alarm that was still active inside. So once they somehow opened, obtained the combination, or discovered, as I alluded, as a possibility that it simply was never erased from day to day, and they utilized the key and unbolted the magnetic alarm, they would have had to turn off the lights on that level so that the switches were off and no lights were evident when they opened the door. And then in the dark, one of these men would have, oh, and there was also this gate, this gated inner door, but that wasn't alarmed, so that was easy enough to pry open with a crowbar. And then they would have had to have one of the guys go in the dark to the precise location where the light alarm was located on the roof, on the ceiling. And to defeat that, it was simply a matter of covering the sensor. It was a little lens, a sensor lens. They just simply covered that with black rubber electrical tape and a couple of strips on top of the sensor, and then they were free to turn the light on. And as far as the light alarm could tell, it was still pitch dark in the room.
Amazing.
And
just
then
amazing.
The final thing was to put the styrofoam shield over the motion detector just to ensure that their body temperature would
double back up.
Certainly raise the ambient temperature inside the room. And then, last but not least, they had to figure out how to get into each of these individual safe deposit boxes.
Well, let's talk about those individual safe deposits, because those were they much bigger than the one that I keep my insurance policies in.
Yeah, maybe not. There were a few that they came in various sizes, and some were, you could easily fit a small, carry-on luggage size suitcase inside. But others were kind of letterbox sizes that were only 3 inches tall. But each of the doors was approximately maybe 10 inches long, 10 inches wide, and then they varied by their height. And so these guys invented a corkscrew type of device that was able to pry them open. And they knew what the inside of the lock looked like because Nota Bartolo was a safe deposit box owner himself, and he took very precise measurements. He most likely took photographs. He diagrammed the inside of the box with great detail and showed his colleagues, okay, here's what it all looks like. And the deadbolt is however many inches long, and it goes into a hole that's about an inch thick or an inch deep inside the hole. And so what they developed was this really elaborate corkscrew where they assembled it out of machined parts that they invented and had fabricated just for this purpose, and they put a little metal steel prong inside the keyhole, and then just by twisting and turning on this handle mechanism that they developed, it slowly pulled the door straight outward. And because the deadbolt was covered inside the door by a plastic faceplate, the plastic quickly gave way and the deadbolt was bowed and the doors were popped open. It took just a few minutes to actually crank them open each time. And then, of course, they had free rein to help themselves to whatever was inside the boxes. And they had enough time to open 109 out of those 189 boxes.
Okay, so 109 out of 189, and what was the criteria for getting for which one they were going to open?
I don't think they had any necessarily criteria other than to open as many as they possibly could. There was no identification on the outside of the box as to who owned it, and there was no real telling what was.
But they didn't go biggest to smallest then? I mean, to go from the big ones to the little letterbox ones?
Well, they sure could have, but you have to keep in mind diamonds are extremely small, and they don't necessarily need to have a lot of space on the inside. They were capable, obviously, of opening, two thirds of these boxes with relative ease, one would assume, and over the course of a few hours. So there was really little to keep them from just trying to open as many as they possibly could. And what it looks like from the diagram, from the crime scene photos, is it looks like they just started at one end and worked their way all the way across. Because there's this one wall of safe deposit boxes that are completely open, and then they moved on to the next wall, and there's a big section that was left untouched that they didn't open, and there's a couple of thoughts on why they didn't open some of these boxes, and the the pulling mechanism worked fine on almost all of them, but there were occasions when it didn't work. And in fact, the metal prong that was used to pull the keyhole outward actually broke off and sheared a couple of different times. And the thieves didn't know it at the time, but those safe deposit boxes were reinforced with steel faceplates that covered the deadbolt as opposed to the plastic faceplates.
I'll be darned.
The majority of the others did. And this was actually a design flaw of the safe deposit boxes in the first place. When they were installed in the 1970s, the company that developed and manufactured the safe doors used the plastic and then realized a couple of years later that this was actually a weak point, and they reissued the doors with the steel faceplates. And my co-author and I managed to track down the locksmith who actually installed the vault in the first place back in the 70s. And when he received notice that there's a more reinforced door that's available, he mentioned it to the building's management and said we should upgrade all of these safe deposit boxes. But that would have been time-consuming and expensive, and it was never done. So from time to time over the years, there would be a door that, you know, the tenant perhaps forgot their combination, or they left and checked out without providing it to the owner so they could open it and rent it to someone else. And so it was his job to actually drill through the doors and break the key mechanism and destroy the door so that he could install a new door. And so those newer doors were the ones with the steel-reinforced backings.
But what was the time frame in order for them? Why did they have to stop at 109 in the here we are in the basement of the Antwerp Diamond Center for people just tuning in, and the thieves are there and they're shoveling, you know, all the diamonds as they can into whatever it is that they brought to carry them out with. Why did they only get 109 of those safety deposit boxes open?
Well, there's two theories on that seem most plausible, and one is that they either ran out of time. They had probably a predetermined time that they decided that they were going to stop and then assemble everything that they had brought with them and make their escape. You know, time tends to fly in situations like that. And with your adrenaline coursing, it can be tempting to stay and continue to stuff your pockets, even if the sun is coming up on the outside and it's a really bad idea to stick around. So they probably had an appointed hour where they said, okay, at 4 a.m., for instance, just to pull a number out of my head, we're leaving, you know, regardless of what we have. We're leaving at exactly 4 a.m. so that we can be on target to get out of here before the sun comes up. Or another theory is that when they were pulling these doors open and the little metal prong broke on the steel-reinforced safe deposit boxes, they brought with them spare parts. They had extra pieces so that they could continue to go forward. Very smart, actually, good forethinking. But they may have run out. So they definitely broke more than one. They broke two or three. I'm not sure the exact number, but they eventually broke off one and left it in the keyhole, as a matter of fact, and it was later discovered, and that was a clue as to how they had done this. So they may have actually run out of spare parts.
Very interesting. So they decide to hoof it, and this is where they actually make their, I think it's their first mistake, and perhaps, I don't know, would you argue, Greg, their only mistake, other than being criminals, in not getting away with the 100 million euros. And I keep using that figure because that's the figure that sticks in my head from all of the news reports. And do we know, has there been a change figure on what they got away with the actual, has it been retabulated or anything, what we know to be the figure?
You know, the estimates have only gone upward, but you're right, 100 million euros, which at the time of the heist would have translated into about 100 and, if I remember right, $120 million worth of diamonds, which is now much higher than that because the exchange rate is different.
Right.
That was what was reported at the time. And when we were revisiting the detectives who investigated this crime, you know, they've actually recalculated now, and they believe it's somewhere in the realm of 400 million euros, which is about a half billion dollars.
It sure is.
That's a lot of money. But we do know from the I should also say that not everybody who was robbed, who was a victim of this crime, even knew what was in their safe deposit boxes. You know, it would sort of be like somebody stole everything out of your closet, and they would come to you and say, Ian, give us a full manifest
right.
of everything that was in your closet. You'd never be able to do it. Similar in this case, you know, there were people who knew they had diamonds. They could just not tell you how many they had or what types, or they didn't keep a list, or
right.
the list was in the safe deposit box and is gone as well. So, So that was why the estimate went up. You know, initially it was about $100 million, and it's just gone up from there.
And this we should say also that not only did they get the diamonds, but then they also got documents that would allow them to establish the ownership of those diamonds. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. Diamonds are. This evolved from the old days. You know, back in the actually prior to the 1970s, the diamond merchants would have to haggle over each and every stone. They would sit there with a loop, and they would argue that the clarity was a certain grade and versus this grade, and each little facet of this exercise, you know, of agreeing on a diamond's characteristics would eventually determine what price the diamond would go for. So, you know, the haggling part was actually extremely important. Well, it was also extremely time-consuming. So the High Diamond Council, Diamond High Council, which is sort of like the governing body of the international industry, came up with an independent certification lab. And for a small price, you could take your diamond there and you could have them analyze it. And it would be an independent, you know, evaluation where they would give an exact weight. It would weigh 1.012 carats. The color would be a D. The internal flaws would be such and such. And they would put all these characteristics into a report. And then they would, importantly, seal the diamond inside like a little plastic blister package. And the diamond would be given a number, a specific number that corresponded to its certificate. And the biggest benefit to this was that it took the haggling out of it about the diamond's characteristics. You could simply show up with a diamond that was sealed in its little plastic container, and you could hand it to somebody, and he would inspect it and say, okay, I see this is the carat weight of this. This is a specific color grade, and it's been analyzed by, you know, this trustworthy diamond lab. So I'm going to take all of this at face value. So let's just move on to the important part, the price we're going to pay for it. And it really opened up the international trade to being able to do it over the internet. You know, people didn't any longer have to sit face-to-face across the table and, you know, stare at the diamonds all day long and argue about, you know, what was the, if it was a D versus an F, which could take
right.
a long, long time. So you would think that because there was a specific number attached to these diamonds, that they would be really easy to trace backwards and establish ownership. But in fact, the number only corresponded to the person who asked the lab to grade it in the first place. Diamonds can trade hands really, really quickly, and the diamond can trade hands 5, 6, 7 times a day. And, you know, over the course of a week, you know, there's just no way to trace it. And if you came into possession of one of these diamonds in the blister package and you wanted to see who it belonged to, you wouldn't be able to do it using the number. You could go back to the lab and say, here's the number.
Right.
You'd say, oh, yeah, sure. You know, 10 days ago, you know, so-and-so asked us to do the thing, and so-and-so would say, oh, yeah, well, I sold that. And it would just be impossible to figure out who actually owned it from that.
But there's no LoJack on every diamond. And
no. And
every diamond doesn't have a number inscribed, like a license plate, where you can track it.
That's right. And even those that do, because there are, you know, for an option, you know, an optional a little bit more money, you can have that certificate number inscribed on the girdle of your diamond using a laser, but you can also remove it using a laser.
Right.
Yeah, grind it off. So.
All right. So they got the diamonds. They got 109 of those 189 boxes. They got the diamonds. They got them out the door. They get to the getaway car, and this is probably where we should mention Speedy.
Yeah, Pietro Tavano.
Enter Speedy.
Yeah. Well, Speedy, you know, is the nickname of Pietro, who was a lifelong friend of Nota Bartolo. And it was his job that night to stay back at the headquarters, you know, where they had their kind of command center in a little rented apartment. And he, you know, was on the phone with the guys in the Diamond Center all night long, and police believe that he was probably monitoring a police scanner just to make sure that the coast was clear, and he provided the transportation to and from the Diamond Center for the thieves. He dropped them off, and he most likely went and picked them up. And then they went back to the apartment. They separated the loot, and more importantly, what they did was they took all the incriminating evidence that they had gathered up. You know, there was a lot of biological evidence. They were wearing gloves. There were documents that could be traced back to them, and they put it all into garbage bags so that they could dispose of it. And at some point, one of the men, and nobody knows who, But one of the men took some of the household trash as well, such as the kitchen trash, and they included it with the rest of this heist garbage. And the heist garbage would have been probably impossible to trace back to these individual men. But the garbage that was in the kitchen trash had things like receipts for purchases from hardware stores and from grocery stores. It had a fake invoice that one man had made for another in case they'd gotten caught kind of sneaking around inside the building in earlier days that had their names on it and the names of certain businesses. So highly incriminating evidence that would have led directly back to these guys. And no one is really certain, you know, who is responsible for the disposal of the trash, but the trash was disposed of in probably like the least fortunate place they could have thought to get rid of it. In retrospect, they certainly should have burned the trash or kept it with them until they could drop it in the Mediterranean Ocean.
Wasn't that the plan? Was that they were going to take the trash with them, take it back to another safe place and burn it?
Yes, that was the plan, according to a version that Nota Bartolo had told to a reporter late last year, a magazine reporter. And that version turned out to be extremely self-serving in a number of ways and is suspicious on its veracity is in high question on a number of different fronts.
Okay.
He did state that the original intention was to take it somewhere and burn it, but at some point it ended up in a forest near Brussels.
Well, and as you say, it ended up at the worst possible place, but they could not have known how bad that place was. There is no way to predict just why that exact space would be the worst place for them to throw the garbage out from the heist. And if they hadn't thrown that garbage out there, it's hard to imagine how they would have gotten caught. And we'll talk more about that coming up in just a minute. The five thieves from what was called the School of Turin that pulled off at least 100 million euros worth of diamonds, maybe as much as 400 million worth. And then how did they get busted? What was that simple mistake that they made? Or rather, the simple fluke that got them busted. And then we'll also take your calls coming up next hour for Greg Campbell. We'll also talk about some of the other heists that have happened since then, too, on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.